anything. She gives me one last look, then she gets back into her black car and drives away. After she's gone, I look down at the card she gave me. I turn it around, and her 10-digit cell number is written in black ink. I stare down at the numbers, which blur as the raindrops continue to fall. Chapter 72. Addie. I eventually have to return home because the rain soaked my jeans. And also I stepped in a huge puddle and now one of my sneakers is waterlogged. My mom is sitting on the sofa in the living room, doing something on her phone. As soon as I step back in the house, she looks up at me sharply. Where did you go? Just for a walk. I step out of my soggy sneakers. Nowhere in particular. She raises her eyebrows. You didn't go anywhere? No, because if you did, I didn't. But I don't tell her Detective Sprague stopped me on the street, or about the business card wedged in my coat pocket. It was just a walk. Seriously, Mom. I'm just worried. She puts down her phone and stands up to face me. She has started looking so old in the last year. I always thought my mom seemed younger and prettier than most moms, but now she looks like she could be somebody's grandma. What they are accusing you of is very serious. You have to understand that. I know. Her eyes grow moist. Addie, please tell me. I won't be mad. Do you know what happened to Mrs. Bennett? The urge to tell her everything becomes almost overwhelming. I remember when I was a little kid, I felt like anything that was wrong, my mom could hug me and make it right again. But there is no way for her to make any of this right again. Part of growing up is figuring out that your parents don't have that ability anymore. No, I don't.
Deny everything.
She swipes at her eyes with the back of her hand. Because you know I'm on your side. But I can't help you if I don't know what happened. I open my mouth, but I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to say. But anything I might have said gets interrupted when the doorbell rings. Oh, no. I bet it's Detective Sprague. I bet she's here to arrest me or something. I'll get it, I say. I hurry over to the front door, and I open it up without checking who is outside. But when I see who is standing there, my mouth falls open. Of all the people I would have imagined might be at my door, this is the last person I expected to see there. It's Kenzie Montgomery. Chapter 73. Addie. Kenzie Montgomery? Great. It's not enough that the police are investigating me for murder. Now my worst enemy from school has shown up at my front door, presumably to torment me. This day just keeps getting better and better. Kenzie is wearing a white coat that I've seen her in before, but now it is drenched by what is becoming fairly heavy rain. Her blonde hair is plastered to her scalp, and her cheeks are bright pink. It's literally the worst I've ever seen her look. What are you doing here? I say in a voice that is decidedly irritable. Kenzie reaches out to wipe a few soggy strands of hair from her face. I need to talk to you. Can I please come in? Part of me is tempted to tell her no. She is the last person I want to deal with right now. But there is something in her blue eyes that keeps me from slamming the door in her face. So I nod and step aside to let her in. Kenzie is dripping wet. A little puddle forms beneath her in our foyer, and I'm hesitant to invite her further inside. My mother quietly goes over to our hall closet and pulls out a towel, which she brings to Kenzie. I'm Addie's mom, she says. How can I help you? Kenzie looks between me and my mother. She reaches out and gnaws on her thumbnail, which is a bad habit I'm shocked she would have. But now, for the first time, I notice that all her fingernails are chewed to bits. Can I talk to you alone, Addie? She says. Please? I look over at my mother. She seems reluctant to leave, but finally she nods and heads up the stairs. There's like a 50-50 chance she's going to be listening at the top of the stairs, but there's not much I can do about that. The walls in this house are thin anyway. Once my mother is out of sight, Kenzie and I go into the living room and sit down on the couch. I sit at one end and she sits all the way at the other end. I don't trust Kenzie. She has put me through hell this semester. I can only imagine she's here to mess with me some more, and I am really, really not in the mood. What is it? I say. Look. Kenzie flips a few wet strands of her hair behind one shoulder. I want to apologize for everything I did to you this year. I was a bitch, and I'm sorry. That's not what I expected her to say at all. Why is she apologizing? And why now? And yet, there's something in her face that looks like she means it. She doesn't have her usual smirk. There are purple circles under her pretty eyes, and one of her nails is bitten so badly, a drop of blood is oozing from the cuticle. Okay, I'm still not sure I trust her, but I'm not going to throw her apology in her face. Fine. Also, she lowers her voice several notches and glances up the stairs, making sure my mother isn't listening. I just wanted to tell you that I know. My stomach does a little flip. Know what? I know about you and Mr. Pennant. Oh no. Of all the people who could find out, she is the worst possible person. If Kenzie knows, soon the whole school will know. And of course the police. It will be horrible. There's only one thing to do.
Deny everything.
I squirm on the sofa. There's nothing to know. Yes, there is. She levels her blue eyes at me. You are sleeping with him. I can see in her eyes that she really does know. She's not asking. She's not digging. She knows. She must have seen us sneaking into the dark room together, or I don't know. Oh my God, this is the worst thing ever. The worst possible person has found out about the worst thing I've ever done. Well, the second worst. I wonder how she found out. I saw the poem, she says. That is the last thing I expected her to say. What? When we were in the cafeteria, and you spilled your lunch tray? She reminds me. That's a nice way of describing the day when she threw my lunch on the ground. There was that poem in your notebook. He wrote that and gave it to you. You know, life nearly passed me by. Then she, young and alive. Stop it! I hold up my hand to get her to stop talking before she ruins my favorite poem forever. I will never forget the verses that Nathaniel wrote just for me. I have every word memorized.
Life nearly passed me by. Then she, young and alive, with smooth hands and pink cheeks, showed me myself. Took away my breath with cherry red lips. Gave me life once again.
I narrow my eyes at Kenzie. How do you know he wrote me that poem? She starts chewing on her fingernail again. Because he didn't write it for you. Yes, he did. Trust me. No, she shakes her head. He wrote it for me. Chapter 74. Addie. My whole world feels like it has just turned upside down. What? What is going on? What is Kenzie talking about? He wrote it for me 2 years ago, she says. I have it memorized. Thankfully, she doesn't try to recite the poem again, because I would have had to run out of the room holding my ears and screaming. I don't understand, I say. Why did he write you a poem? Because Nate and I have been sleeping together since my freshman year.
No.
No.
That's not possible. She's making this up just to torture me. I refuse to believe it.
I was on the school newspaper, she explains. We were both staying late one day while he was helping me with an article I was writing, and we got to talking.
She takes a shaky breath.
My brother had cancer at the time. Well, he still has it, but he's in remission. Leukemia. He was getting chemo and he was sick all the time, and it felt like nobody in my family even knew I existed anymore. I know that sounds selfish, but
I remember that bottle of pills I found in Kenzie's medicine cabinet, prescribed for her brother, for nausea. I had no idea he had leukemia. They must have kept it quiet.
Nate was so kind to me, she murmurs. He paid so much attention to me in a way that my parents never did anymore. And he's so, I mean, I couldn't stop thinking about him. So when he kissed me,
this doesn't make sense.
Nathaniel told me he had never been unfaithful to his wife before. Also, if he was with Kenzie since she was a freshman, she was only 14 years old then. Nathaniel would never. He told me I was his soulmate. She lets out a barking laugh. I completely believed it. I was so stupidly in love with him. I would have done absolutely anything for him. And then when all that stuff happened with you and Mr. Tuttle, he said we had to cool it. He couldn't see me anymore because there was too much scrutiny. She chews on her nail again. That's why I was so mad at you this year. Nate barely spoke to me, and I felt like it was all your fault, even though I realize now how dumb that was. And I'm sorry for how I treated you.
But what about Hudson? I blurt out. I thought he was your boyfriend.
She shakes her head. No, Hudson and I are just friends, that's all. He's a nice guy who's been really kind to me while I've been struggling this year. But nothing happened between us. I was too hung up on Nate. It's true that I never saw Hudson and Kenzie kissing. They seemed to be together a lot, but I never saw them making out in the hall like some other couples.
And then I saw that poem in your notebook.
She rubs her slightly pink nose.
And I realized he must have given it to you, too. And I felt so stupid. I realized that the whole time, he was playing me. I bet he said all the same things to you that he said to me.
I don't know what to say. I thought Nathaniel was the most amazing man I had ever met or would ever meet. And now I'm beginning to wonder if I might have had it all wrong.
I don't know what happened with Mrs. Bennett, she says. But I'm going to go to the police and tell them everything that happened between me and Nate. And I'm hoping you'll come with me so we can do it together.
I shake my head. Kenzie has a lot of evidence, and yeah, it sounds bad. But Kenzie is my enemy. She's been tormenting me all year. How can I believe her?
I was only 14, Addie. Her lower lip trembles. I feel so stupid for believing everything he told me and letting him do all that stuff to me. It messed me up so bad. I just want to keep him from doing it to anyone else.
She sniffles loudly.
Please come with me.
Her shaky voice is breaking my resolve. I've never seen her be anything but perfectly poised. I wring my hands together. They're probably not even going to believe us. I don't have any proof at all. We only talked on Snapflash, and all those messages are gone.
Nate and I talked on Snapflash, too, she says. But I took screenshots.
You did?
She bobs her head. At the time, I did it because I wanted to remember what he was saying to me. But they're all there. All the lies he told me.
She digs into the bag hanging off her shoulder and pulls out her phone. She brings up a photo on the screen, and that's when I see it.
You're my soulmate.
The same words he had written for me, but for Kenzie. I'm too sick to keep reading. I shove the phone back in her direction and turn away, blinking back tears. Is it all real? Could Nathaniel really have said the same exact words to Kenzie that he said to me? This must be some kind of prank. Except when I look at Kenzie's face, I know it's not. She reaches out and takes my hand in hers. Please, Addie, please come with me. I don't want to be the only one. With my free hand, I reach into my jeans pocket, where I move the card that Detective Sprague gave me earlier today. I pull it out to look at the number scrawled on the back. The ink is slightly blurred by the rain, but I can still read every single digit. Okay, I say. I'll go. Chapter 75. Addie. I am absolutely terrified. When we came to the police station, they put us in a tiny room that gave me a creepy, crawly, claustrophobic feeling in the back of my neck. The lighting is scary dark, and the two plastic chairs look uncomfortable. And when we sit on them, they feel uncomfortable. If I were here alone, I would be terrified. But I'm not alone. I'm with Kenzie. I didn't tell my mother what I was doing. She would have insisted on hiring a lawyer and making it into a whole thing. And then I would have lost my nerve. So I told my mother I was going to take a walk with Kenzie. But instead, we came here. By now, I think I might have made a mistake. I should have waited for a lawyer. Or maybe just said nothing at all. Kenzie sounded so sure of herself, but it's not like she's my best friend. She's been tormenting me all year. And now somehow I trust her? Kenzie is obsessively playing with the lock of her blonde hair. She's tugging at it hard enough that I can't help but wince, and she frowns at the silky blonde strands as if angry at them. My hair is like straw, she complains. I look at her in disbelief. Kenzie has the most perfectly silky hair I've ever seen. And why is she worrying about her freaking hair when we're at a police station? You have beautiful hair. She rolls her eyes at me and goes back to making faces at her hair. I am losing it, waiting for Detective Sprague to talk to us. Maybe she was nice to me on the street, but that could have all been a fake out. And what I am going to tell her is bad stuff. Kenzie had an affair with Nathaniel, but what I did is much worse. I helped him bury a dead body, and I'm not even entirely sure which of us was the one who killed her. It feels like an eternity, but it's really more like 20 minutes before Detective Sprague comes into the room. She's still got her hair in that bun, but it is loosened over the course of the day, and that makes her face look softer. I hope she really is on my side. I hope I don't spend the rest of my life in prison. I look over at Kenzie, who is still playing with her hair. Very reluctantly, she tucks the strands behind her ear and raises her eyes to look at the detective. Hello, Addie, Sprague says. Then she turns to Kenzie and gives her a curious look. Kenzie Montgomery? Kenzie nods. Addie and I need to talk to you about Nathaniel Bennett. Sprague doesn't look particularly surprised. She sits in one of the plastic chairs across from us and folds her fingers together. I'm listening, she says. Kenzie and I exchange looks. We hadn't agreed beforehand who would go first. I don't want to go first, and I guess I assumed Kenzie would since it was her idea to come here. Kenzie? Sprague prompts her. Kenzie glances at me, panic in her eyes, then looks back at the detective. Oh, well, we just... Is this about Mr. Bennett? Kenzie nods wordlessly. Sprague's voice softens. About your relationship with Mr. Bennett? Kenzie bows her head, nodding slowly. The detective is quiet, waiting for Kenzie to say something more, but she seems too choked up to say another word. Even though it was her idea to come here, she doesn't look like she can go on. She squeezes her knees with her chewed-up fingernails as her eyes fill with tears. I always thought Kenzie seemed so mature, but right now, she looks so young, like a little girl. She was only 14 when Nathaniel slept with her. 14! And Nathaniel? He's almost 40. He's an adult. Our teacher. I was hurt when I realized that Nathaniel lied to me, but this is the first time that it all hits home. What he did to us was truly horrible. Unthinkable. He needs to pay. And Kenzie and I are the only ones who can make sure he gets what he deserves. Detective Sprague, I blurt out. The truth is, Mr. Bennett and I have been sleeping together the entire year. He told me not to tell anyone. Detective Sprague shakes her head, her eyes on fire. She looks like she wants to take that gun off her holster and empty a few rounds into Nathaniel Bennett. She hasn't been lying about wanting to help me. You can't fake the look in her eyes. That bastard. I reach out for Kenzie's hand, and she gives it to me. We are going to do this together. We are going to tell the truth. I don't care what kind of trouble I get into. I am tired of lying for that man. He deserves everything that is about to happen to him. Now, Addie, the detective says, tell me what happened to Eve Bennett. And I do. I tell her everything.
Chapter 76. Nate. I've spent the last 2 hours driving around in the rain. I was losing my mind at home, worrying about Detective Sprague returning to question me and what she might say, so I had to get out of the house. I drove around town, listening to classical music and letting my mind wander. At one point, I drove by Simon's Shoes, which used to be Eve's favorite shoe store, and for a moment, a wave of sorrow came over me. I used to love her. I truly did. It's dark by the time I return home. I pull into the garage since it's raining and enter the house through there. Just as I'm stepping into the living room, my phone rings in my pocket. When I pull it out, the same number Sprague was calling from this morning is flashing on the screen. I don't want to answer it. I don't want to receive any more updates from a woman who I am increasingly certain believes I murdered my wife. But if I don't answer the phone, she will surely come here. So I take the call. Hello, I say. Mr. Bennett? Her voice echoes slightly, like she's on speakerphone. Where are you, Mr. Bennett? I'm home. You are? Because we were just there, and you didn't answer your door. They were here? I'm glad I missed them. Yes, sorry. I went out for a drive. It's been hard, sitting around the house, waiting for news. Mr. Bennett, we need to speak to you as soon as possible, she says. I'm going to send that patrol car back around to pick you up. A patrol car? My mouth goes dry. Why are you sending a patrol car? Am I under arrest? No, not at this time. Not at this time. That doesn't sound positive, and there's a hard edge to her voice that wasn't present yesterday. She's received new information. I wonder if Addie broke and told her about the two of us. Even worse, what if Kenzie went to the police? That would be cataclysmic. Kenzie was only 14 when our relationship commenced. If she goes to the police, I'm in deep trouble. The kind of trouble where I'll be wearing an orange jumpsuit, and when I get out, I won't be able to live a certain radius from a playground. That kind of trouble. To be fair, Kenzie didn't look 14. She was exquisitely beautiful. More beautiful than 99% of all grown women out there. Most people don't understand what it's like to have all these beautiful young girls throwing themselves at you year in and year out. I'm not made of stone. Mr. Bennett, Sprague is saying, are you there? I Yes. I choke out. I'm here. Great. Stay put. I'll have a patrol car there in a few minutes. The line goes dead, and I am left staring at my phone, a growing sensation of dread in my chest. I almost feel like I'm choking. I need some water. I need some water before I suffocate. I hurry into the kitchen to grab a glass of water. I race over to the sink, snatch a cup from one of the cupboards, and fill it with lukewarm water. I down the entire glass, and then I stand there, still gasping for air. And that's when I see it. Right in the middle of my kitchen, in the exact spot where I found Eve's shoes yesterday. It's a pumpkin. A jack-o'-lantern, to be specific. Of course, Halloween has already passed, and for that reason, the pumpkin has started to rot. The rotting flesh of the pumpkin has caused its features to become distorted. What used to be a toothy grin has morphed into an evil grimace. And then, as I take a step closer, the jack-o'-lantern moves. What the hell? Now it shifts even more violently, and a second later a black bird shoots out of the top of the pumpkin. Is it a raven? I startle, backing up against the kitchen counter as the bird flaps its wings, trying to escape from my kitchen. After a few failed attempts, it rests on top of the jack-o'-lantern for a moment, staring at me. Nevermore. I grasp at strands of my hair with the tips of my fingers. Who is doing this to me? Who is talking to the detective about me? Why is this all happening? It's not Addie. I don't believe she would do this to me. I don't think Kenzie would do it either. The truth is, there's only one person I believe to be capable of this. I've got to get out of here. Chapter 77. Nate. I'm driving far too fast. If I get pulled over by the police, it will all be for nothing, and I'll be in trouble with Sprague for leaving the house when she instructed me to stay put. But then again, I am already in trouble with Sprague. If I go to that police station, I will likely never leave. It's still raining, and my Honda only has front-wheel drive, so I need to slow the hell down and be more careful. Eve always told me to get a car with four-wheel drive, but I was stubborn. In spite of everything, in spite of what might happen to me if the police catch up with me, I do not want to be killed in a fiery car wreck tonight. Death is worse than prison. Before, I was driving aimlessly, roaming the streets and willing to go anywhere but home. But now, I know exactly where I'm going. I'm going back to that pumpkin patch. It's risky, but I need to do this. I need to prove to myself that my wife is truly dead and buried among the rotting pumpkins. If I get to that patch and find her grave intact and her body rotting in the earth, that can only mean her soul has returned to haunt me. Because there is nobody but Eve who would plant a raven in my kitchen. It takes me over an hour because it's raining, and because, unlike during the wee hours of Saturday morning, there is some amount of traffic. While I am making the drive, my phone rings several times. I am certain it is Detective Sprague, but I allow each call to go to voicemail. At long last, I reach the narrow road leading to the pumpkin patch. Unlike on Saturday morning when the road was dry and crumbling, the rain has turned the soil moist, and my tires slip on the fresh mud. But even so, I drive until I can go no further. And now I have to go the rest of the way on foot. At least I thought to bring my boots, and I'm wearing a waterproof coat. I tug on my beanie and put up my hood as I climb out of the car. Immediately, my feet slip out from under me, but I manage to catch myself before I fall. My fingers are tingling with anticipation. I should never have left Addie here alone. I should have helped her finish burying Eve's body. I thought she could handle it alone, but now I realize I made a terrible mistake. But Eve was dead. I saw the life drain out of her with my own eyes. I couldn't feel a pulse in her neck. She wasn't breathing. At least, I don't think she was. I'm hardly a doctor. I squint through the rain until I can see the sign for the pumpkin patch, overgrown with weeds and now covered in mud and rain. My boots sink into the mud with every step, and it feels like it takes half an hour to traverse the small distance to the patch. And when I finally make it there, I'm breathing hard. But I can't stop. I'm too close. I know exactly where we buried her. I walk across the pumpkin patch, stepping over rotting pumpkins that look much like what's in my kitchen. I chose the space right by the old chicken coop. I step closer, expecting to see an irregular mound of dirt. But that's not what I see. I see a gaping hole in the ground, roughly 2 feet by 6 feet. My heart is pounding. Christ, I don't want to drop dead of a heart attack in this pumpkin patch in the middle of nowhere. I step over to the grave we dug 2 nights ago, and I lean forward, squinting into the darkness. I expect to see the navy sheet that had covered my wife's body. Or perhaps animals have chewed through it, and instead her partially decomposed corpse is lying at the bottom of this hole. But none of that is there. The grave is empty. I fall to my knees, sinking into the mud as tears prick my eyes. Aside from the sound of the pouring rain, the pumpkin graveyard is silent. The silence is unbroken, and the only word spoken is my own whisper. Eve. And as I wait for an echo to murmur back the word, something slams into the back of my head, and everything goes black.
Part 3. Chapter 78. Eve. If you've never been buried alive, I don't recommend it. Taphyphobia is the fear of being buried alive. In biblical times, people were wrapped in shrouds and their bodies were placed in caves, so somebody could check on them days later to be certain they were actually dead. Even George Washington requested that he not be buried until 2 days after his death. In the past, during epidemics, safety coffins were developed, which included a device, such as a cord attached to a bell, for the allegedly deceased to signal to the outside world if they were still among the living. Such a device would not have been useful to me, since the people who attempted to murder me were the ones who buried me and left me in the middle of nowhere, in hopes that I would never be found. Finding myself buried under the dirt was one of the worst experiences I have ever had in my entire life. But it's not worse than what's about to happen to my husband. 2 nights earlier. Where am I? Everything is dark. The last thing I remember is Nate's fingers wrapped around my neck, squeezing. First he was choking me, and then I blacked out. I can hardly move. My body feels like it's wrapped in something, a sheet or blanket, which is keeping me still. And then there's a layer of something else on top of that, something cold and heavy. And then I hear the sound of a shovel digging into the earth. My head is throbbing, and it feels like there are knives in my throat when I try to swallow. I am lying on something cold, irregular, and very uncomfortable. It makes it hard to focus on what is happening around me. The shovel scrapes against the ground again, and this time it is accompanied by something hitting me in the leg. I close my eyes against the blackness, trying to get my thoughts in order. I think... Oh, God. They're trying to bury me. If that's true, then I don't know what to do next. I could scream or try to break free from this sheet I'm wrapped in, but considering my husband has already tried to strangle me to death once, and Addie clocked me with the frying pan, I don't want to give them a third shot at me. I doubt I will survive a third time. But I can't let them bury me alive. While I am weighing out my options, a young female voice above me calls out, "Nathaniel?" There's a long silence in which there is no digging or dirt falling on me. She calls out his name once again, but I don't hear my husband's voice. There's a rustling sound and a shadow of something darker above me.
It feels like it's about to land on me, and I brace myself for a heavy impact. But instead, it feels light. Leaves? What little moonlight I could see becomes obscured as more leaves are shuffled on top of me. But I remain still. I don't move. I don't scream. Nathaniel! She calls out one last time. Her voice sounds farther away. So do her footsteps. I take a shallow breath, just to reassure myself that I still can. Although I have been buried in the dirt, I am not in a coffin 6 feet under. I am wrapped in some sort of sheet, and it feels like there's only a thin layer of dirt on top of me, and then perhaps some leaves. The sheet is preventing me from inhaling any dirt. I'm not going to suffocate down here. The only thing that will kill me is if they find out I am still alive. So as painful as it is, I wait, shivering in the dirt with a bunch of soggy leaves as my blanket. I wait until the sound of footsteps has completely disappeared, and then I wait another hour after that. I think it's an hour anyway. It's hard to know what time it is when you're buried in your own grave. Once enough time has passed, I decide to attempt to get out of here. That is not incredibly easy. Despite the fact that I am not buried under 6 feet of dirt, the shallow layer of dirt and the leaves do have some amount of weight, and on top of that, I'm wrapped in the sheet like a mummy, all of which means I'm completely pinned down. On top of that, my head is throbbing. It would be accurate to say that every part of my body hurts. My first attempts don't get me very far. I struggle to sit up, to get the sheet loose, but it just gets me frustrated. And then I start to panic. What if I can't get out? I'm hyperventilating now. There isn't much fresh air down here, and I can't take the deep breaths I want. My fingertips start to tingle. I'm trapped. I'm never going to get out of here. What if I really die down here?
No. That's impossible. My hands aren't tied down. I can get free. I will get free.
After all, it's the only way to make sure my husband pays for what he tried to do to me. The second time, I do better. I find a corner of the sheet, and I start working my way free. When my hands first feel the dirt, I know I have gotten loose. But I need to be careful. I don't want to inhale a lung full of dirt and suffocate. It takes me the better part of another hour, but I finally claw my way free from my own grave. The second my head breaks through the surface, I take a big gasp of fresh air. I thought I was going to die down there. It's freezing, but I don't even care. I don't care about anything except the fact that I'm no longer buried alive. That was the most terrifying thing I have ever experienced. As I struggle to get to my feet, I look at my surroundings. What is this place? It looks like some sort of graveyard, except for pumpkins instead of humans. How the hell am I going to get back to civilization? And then I see something lying in the sheet that I just escaped from. Oh my God, it's my purse. They buried it here with me. I snatch it off the ground and dig around inside. I gasp with joy when I find my phone inside. It's powered down, but when I press the button on the side, the screen lights up. Unfortunately, there's no service. But if I keep walking, I'm sure to reach a place where I can get a bar or two. I'm going to get home. And then I'm going to make Nate pay for this. Chapter 79. Eve. They buried me without any shoes on. If only I had taken those few seconds to put on my sneakers before I confronted Addie in the kitchen, this journey back to the road would be much easier. Instead, I am carefully picking my way along the uneven dirt, branches stabbing the soles of my feet. On top of that, I'm freezing. I took the sheet with me, and I fashioned it into a makeshift shawl to try to keep me warm. It's got to be below freezing, though. After I've been walking for about half an hour, I come to what looks like a small road. I dig my phone back out from inside my purse. Hallelujah, I've got cell service. One bar? It's a miracle. I start to dial 911, but then I stop myself. I could call the police and get my husband thrown in jail for what he did to me. But he'll get a lawyer and be out on bail a few days later. Get a few women on the jury and, let's face it, he would probably end up with a slap on the wrist. If it even went to trial at all. Nate has a way of weaseling out of things. No, I have to make sure that he pays for all the things he has done. So instead, I send a message to the only person I can think of who might be willing to come get me in the middle of the night. Jay takes 20 minutes to respond to my snap flash message. 20 minutes of me shivering on the side of the road, wondering if the alert sound will be enough to wake him. I have his number, but it's too risky to call him. Just when I'm considering giving up and calling the police, his name flashes on the screen of my phone. He almost never calls me, and I imagine him hiding in the bathroom of his house so that she doesn't hear him and he doesn't wake the baby. Eve? He says. What's going on? I need you to pick me up, I tell him. I'm sorry, I know it's early. My watch reads almost 5 in the morning. Where are you? He's coming for me, thank God. I wait for him on the side of the road, shivering underneath my sheet. I hope I don't get pneumonia. When I finally spot his car pulling up along the side of the road, I burst into tears. Salt water is running down my cheeks when I climb into the car beside him. He looks startled by my appearance. Eve, he says, where are your shoes? That only makes me cry harder. Jay doesn't make me explain, though. He just starts driving, and we sit together in silence while I cry quietly. When we get back to Kasem, I start to tell him not to go to my house. But then I notice he's going in a different direction. A few minutes later, he pulls into the parking lot for Simon's shoes. Come on, he says. Let's get you some shoes. I follow him out of the car, the parking lot pavement cold against the soles of my feet. He peels off the sheet on top of me, still wrapped around me like it's a shawl, and he gives me his own coat, even though it's not far to the entrance of the store. Then he takes my hand, and we walk together to the door of the shoe store. He grabs the key from his pocket and unlocks the door. Take whatever you want, he tells me. I select a pair of hideous black snow boots, different from anything else I have in my closet, but they're on sale. I start digging around in my purse, searching for my wallet. Of course, I need to pay cash.
Don't worry about it, Jay says. I said don't worry about it, really.
I don't argue with him further. I put on the black snow boots, and even though they're ugly, they immediately warm up my feet. I keep Jay's coat on, and I drop down onto one of the benches. He sits beside me, not saying a word. He's being very patient, even though soon the sun will come up. Nate, I choose my words carefully. I don't want him to know Addie was involved, too. No good can come of that. Anyway, this is between me and my husband. He tried to kill me. Jay looks up at me, his expression frozen in horror. He tried to bury me in the dirt, I say, but I wasn't dead. I waited for him to leave, and then I got back to the road.
Eve, he breathes. I shiver under his coat. I want him to pay for this.
We'll call the police right now.
No, I say firmly. I want to do this my way. I want to make sure that he pays for everything he has done. His brows knit together below that jagged scar on his hairline.
Okay.
Is there anywhere you know that I can stay for a few days?
We have a tool shed, he says thoughtfully. It's out in the back. Nobody ever uses it. I could stick a sleeping bag out there. It won't be comfortable, but it's warm enough with the door closed.
Perfect, I say.
And there are a few other things I need your help with. He looks at me with absolute devotion in his eyes.
I will do whatever you want.
And he does.
Chapter 80. Eve. It was Jay who hit Nate on the head with a rock and knocked him out. I wanted to do it, but logically it made more sense for Jay to do it. He is taller than Nate and likely stronger. If I did it, I might not have knocked him out. I couldn't risk that. Not after the things I did to ensure he would end up in this very spot. Jay and I have spent the last 2 days tormenting my husband. It was risky, but worth it. I knew after he saw that raven in the kitchen, he would be convinced I was still alive and end up right here. Nobody else but me would torment him that way. The Raven, his favorite poem of all time. I know it all too well. Nate is unconscious on the ground, his handsome features slack. I want to take the rock from Jay and hit him again, but I need him to be able to wake up because we are far from done. He'll regain consciousness soon, so we have to act quickly. Jay reaches into the pocket of his coat and pulls out a roll of duct tape. He holds it out to me.
Want to do the honors? He asks.
I certainly do. I bind my husband's wrists together in front of him, and then I bind his ankles as well. As I finish tying his ankles together, he groans on the muddy ground. His eyes slowly crack open. He's waking up, I tell Jay. Throw him in the hole. If Nate wasn't awake before, dropping him into that shallow pool of freezing cold water does the trick. His eyelids flutter open, and he stares up at me, blinking against the droplets of rain. Jay stays carefully out of sight.
Eve?
Nate croaks. I don't say anything. I allow him a moment to take stock of his situation. The fact that he is lying in a shallow grave, in a pool of muddy water, and his wrists and ankles are bound together. I watch the panic dawning on his face.
Eve!
He gasps.
What are you doing? What's going on?
I stare down at my husband. When I stood before him in front of a judge on our wedding day, the happiest day of my life, I never imagined that I could hate him as much as I do at this moment.
You tried to kill me. You buried me in this hole.
Nate shifts, struggling to keep his face above the muddy water in the grave.
I'm so sorry I did that, Eve. I made a terrible mistake. That's why I came back.
That's not why you came back.
You came back to make sure I was really dead.
His Adam's apple bobs.
Okay, fine. You're right. I did a terrible thing. I'm a terrible person.
He blinks water out of his eyes again.
But you're not. This isn't you. I know you. You don't know me.
I bark out a laugh.
You haven't known me in years. And you definitely don't love me. I admit we've had our problems.
I laugh again. Have we now? Nate is struggling to sit up, trying to keep his head above the shallow pool that is formed at the bottom of the grave.
Please, Eve, this isn't you. You don't want to do this. It won't solve your problems.
Yes, you know all about my problems, don't you?
Considering you are the cause of all of them.
Fine, that's fair.
When he speaks, some of the muddy water gets into his mouth, and he grimaces and spits it out.
Just get me out of here, and we can talk about this. I'll do whatever you want me to do.
No, I say quietly. That's not going to happen.
Eve!
The panic in his face is intensified. He starts struggling against his restraints.
You realize I'm going to drown in here, right? Please stop messing around. Whatever you want, I'll give it to you. I'll quit teaching. Leave down. Whatever you want, okay?
Don't worry, I tell him. I'm not going to let you drown. For a moment, his shoulders relax and he stops his struggle with the duct tape.
Good. Thank you.
I know you wouldn't.
I pick up the shovel lying on the ground beside me. I'm going to bury you first. With those words, I scoop up a shovel full of dirt, and I throw it on top of him.
Eve!
He screams.
Jesus Christ, what is wrong with you? Have you lost your mind?
I scoop up more dirt and throw it into the hole.
Eve!
His face is bright red.
Eve, sweetheart, I'm so sorry for everything. I love you. You have to know that. You can't do this to me.
And another scoop of dirt goes into the hole.
Eve,
he gasps.
Don't do this to me. Eve!
Nate is thrashing now in the grave, trying to get free. But he isn't going to. I tied him up much too tightly. I'm about to scoop in more dirt when Jay grabs my arm. He tugs me away, out of the earshot of my husband.
Eve,
he says,
you're going to kill him.
I lift my chin. I know. Jay glances over at the grave, where my husband is screaming his lungs out, even though nobody can hear him but us.
He's right. It won't solve your problems to kill him.
You'd be surprised. His brows bunch together.
Are you sure you want to do this?
I've never been so sure of anything in my life. Jay stares at me for a moment, then he picks up his own shovel. He walks back with me to the grave, and when I scoop up some dirt and throw it in the hole, he does the same.
Eve!
Nate screams.
For the love of God, Eve, don't do this! You can't do this!
I can, and I will. Two more scoops of dirt go into the hole.
You'll go to jail. You know that, right? You're going to spend the rest of your life rotting in jail, you crazy bitch!
Two more scoops of dirt. One of them hits him in the face, and he starts to sob.
Please, Eve.
His left eye is obscured by mud as he stares up at me.
Please don't do this, Evie. I'm begging you. Please.
Nate once said to me that he thinks death is like being on the precipice of an abyss, or some pretentious garbage like that. He was terrified of death, more than anything else in the world. I don't know if I believe in an afterlife, but if I do, I am certain that my husband will spend the rest of it burning in hell. He alternates between begging us to stop and screaming threats until the mud completely covers his face. Shortly after that, he goes blessedly silent. We keep shoveling in dirt until the hole is completely filled. And as I put the finishing touches on my husband's grave in the woods, I recite to myself the poem he once wrote for me many years ago, back when I was 15 years old. And he was my English teacher fresh out of college, who swore to me I was his soulmate. Life nearly passed me by. Then she, young and alive, with smooth hands and pink cheeks, showed me myself, took away my breath with cherry red lips, gave me life once again. Epilogue. Addie. 6 months later. When I get to the school parking lot, Hudson is leaning against his car, talking to some of his football buddies, even though the season is over. I watched every single game, and Hudson killed it. He deserves the title of star quarterback. He's going to get a scholarship to a great college. They're all going to be fighting over him. When Hudson sees me, he raises a hand in greeting.
Addie,
he calls out, as if I could possibly miss him. I jog the rest of the way over, a dopey smile plastered on my face. I'm smiling a lot more lately. Ever since I got my best friend back, the world seems a lot brighter. I'm still not Miss Popularity, but I don't care. Hudson is all I ever needed. And this year has definitely been wild. After Kenzie and I talked to Detective Sprague, she attempted to get an officer to bring in Nathaniel, but then he took off. I guess he knew he was in deep trouble and decided it was better to disappear than to be labeled as a sex offender.
They might have searched harder for him, except Mrs. Bennett suddenly materialized. She had some story about deciding to take a bus somewhere to get away for a few days. She paid in cash, she said, and she had no idea everyone was searching for her. Sprague had my story on record about what Nathaniel and I did to her, but she refused to confirm it. And she was not, in fact, dead and buried, so there was nothing the police could do. Of course, Mrs. Bennett and I both know the truth. And we both know that if I had buried her with dirt instead of leaves, everything could have gone very differently. In any case, she never returned to Kasem High. She resigned when the scandal came out with her husband, and then she left town. We ended up with a substitute teacher for the rest of the term. I wished it could have been Mr. Tuttle, but I heard through the grapevine he got another job at a high school two towns over. They're lucky to have him. As for Mr. Bennett, it turns out that Kenzie and I weren't the only soulmates he had among his students. It makes me sick when I think about it sometimes. I feel so stupid. One thing I'm grateful for is that I have Kenzie to talk about it with. She and I have for real become close friends this year. We have spent hours talking about Nathaniel. It makes me feel better that somebody as smart and beautiful and popular as Kenzie Montgomery could be taken in exactly like I was. And she says talking to me makes her feel better about the whole thing, too. Plus, we're both getting professional talk therapy. It all helps.
Took you long enough? Hudson teases me when I reach his car. What were you doing in there?
I was late because Lotus and I were putting the finishing touches on the poetry magazine, which we have been doing entirely ourselves since Nathaniel took off. But I don't want to tell him that, because I want it to be a surprise when he sees the magazine. Sorry, I'm here now at least. One of Hudson's football buddies laughs.
Your girl really got you whipped. How long does she have you waiting for anyway?
Hudson laughs too. And he doesn't correct his friend who called me his girl. It makes me wonder. Especially since when we walk from his car to the school every morning, he sometimes reaches out and takes my hand in his. He's not dating Kenzie, at least. I'm pretty sure he was seeing some girl at the beginning of the year, but not anymore.
You taking off, then?
One of the guys says to Hudson as he opens the door for me. It's unnecessary he does that. But it's sweet.
Uh-huh, Hudson says. Addie and I are going to get some milkshakes before I have to get to work. See you later, Walsh.
Later, Jay,
the other kid says to Hudson. As Hudson climbs into the driver's seat next to me, I say to him, okay, I've got to ask. How come all your football buddies call you Jay?
Well, you know, we all call each other by our last names, he says. Jankowski? That's a mouthful. So they just call me Jay for short. I kind of like it.
That's fine, but he'll always be Hudson to me.
All right, he says. We better go. My shift at the shoe store starts at 5, so we've only got 1 hour for milkshakes.
Hudson really does work harder than anyone else. Aside from school, he works at Simon's Shoes several days a week. And he also babysits his one-year-old brother all the time. But even with all that going on, he always makes time for me. We pull up into the lot near the diner that has the best milkshakes in the entire town. I wonder if we'll share a single milkshake. And if we do, what will that mean? I'd like Hudson. A lot. Is he my soulmate? I don't know. I kind of think that's a stupid question. Just after he parks, Hudson's phone buzzes, and he pulls it out of his pocket. He reads a text message, and a smile touches his lips. What? I say. He shoves the phone back in his pocket.
Nothing. Just this old friend of mine.
Girlfriend? His smile becomes sheepish as he rubs the scar he got on his forehead back when we were stupid kids worming under the fence surrounding his house.
You could say that. She really liked shoes and used to come to the shoe store all the time and, yeah.
Hudson's pale skin turns bright pink,
which makes me think this customer at the shoe store was a whole lot more than just a customer. But for whatever reason, he doesn't want to admit it. Of course, that makes me wonder even more who she was, and if he had fallen for her the way I'm starting to fall for him.
Anyway, he says, she was having a hard time for a while and was pretty messed up. But she's doing a lot better now. I've known her for a while, and she seems happy for the first time ever, so that's nice, you know? I want her to be happy. She deserves it.
Definitely a girlfriend. I can see it all over his face. I wonder if this is the same girlfriend he had at the beginning of the year, but I'm afraid to ask. Anyway, it's none of my business. He's not with her anymore. We both get out of the car, and Hudson reaches for my hand. He laces his fingers into mine, and when he smiles at me, I smile back. As we walk to the diner together, I decide that I am going to get a vanilla milkshake with a lot of whipped cream and a cherry on top, because I deserve a treat. The end. Acknowledgements. When I was writing the teacher, I said to my teenager, "Do you think you could write me a poem that a teenager would think is really deep, but it's actually painfully bad?" In response, she sat down beside me, snatched the laptop from my lap, and said, "Give me 2 minutes." I then watched her create the greatest bad poem I had ever seen. I was blown away. "It's so perfect," I told her before I obviously changed a bunch of things. With the publication of The Teacher on the horizon, I reminded her of that poem she wrote for me. I told her how much I loved it and that I was going to give her credit for the poem in the acknowledgments. And she said, "Ugh, please don't." Maybe I shouldn't have told that story. Well, she's not going to read this book anyway because she would rather die. Someday when she's all grown up, she'll have this to look back on and feel mildly embarrassed and/or nostalgic. Thank you also to Jenna Jankowski, who Hudson absolutely was not named after, but it just proves some things are truly kismet, for your amazing feedback and help with shaping this book into the story it became, as well as to the entire Sourcebooks team for an incredible job. Thank you to my mother, who always is the first one to read my books and never, ever understands the twist at the ending. Thank you to my beta readers, Pam, Kate, and Emily. Thank you to Daniel and Vale for excellent proofreading. And a huge thank you to my agent, Christina Hogerby, and the JRA team for your support. Last but definitely not least, thank you, thank you, thank you to all my readers. I am genuinely just so grateful to all the readers out there who have supported me on my journey. I hope my books have brought you even a tiny bit as much joy as it has given me to see so many people reading them. Did you enjoy reading The Teacher? Check out other unputdownable psychological thrillers by Freida McFadden, now available on Amazon and Audible. This has been The Teacher. Written by Freida McFadden. Narrated by Leslie Howard. Copyright 2023 by Freida McFadden. Production copyright by Freida McFadden.